This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
So, I don't have a watch, but we'll try to make this a dialogue and not a monologue. We'd love to hear what you all have to say. Let me give you just a little background. Chuck alluded to it, but how the book evolved and the format it took and what I hope to accomplish. First, some disclaimers. I got asked to do this for St. Albans in Waco, a very fine church, good rector, good friend of mine. And I started it by saying, there's three groups of people that don't need to stay here. You're welcome to leave now. If you think healthcare is perfect, great, love you. I can't change your opinion. If you think I have all the answers, you're going to be sorry because I don't. I'm going to raise more provocative questions than I have answers for. And if you think the healthcare system is broken beyond repair, this is not for you. Because I think, although it has its challenges and its problems, I think it's still a wonderful gift to our culture, to civilization. We just have to be frank and honest about how things have gotten where we are today. So these articles that Chuck said took me several years while I was teaching at Baylor. I began to tell stories to pre-med students. Our curriculum we put together was called Medical Humanities. It was a chance for pre-med students to take classes in spirituality, healthcare, literature and medicine, the nature of the patient-physician relationship, philosophy of healthcare. I taught most of those at various stages over 18 and 19 years. And I found myself, as I was teaching, like a lot of people, you wind up telling stories. So rather than overwhelming students with data and facts and crisis flashpoint analysis, I told stories to try to illustrate what I thought were important checkpoints in our healthcare journey. Out of those stories, I began to write, and like good writing sometimes happens, it comes to an end. Our local paper got sold by a private owner that I had a contract with to the Warren Buffett Media Holding Company. Warren Buffett was at that time buying newspapers all over the country. And there were six of us local writers from different specialist careers. And their legal team sent me a letter saying, we'd like you to keep writing, but we want all the intellectual property rights to your past and future articles. And I had signed a contract with my friend, the owner and publisher, Clifton Robinson, and that I owned those articles, and I didn't intend to sign a damn contract. Bottom line is I got a pink slip, which is pretty interesting. I'd never gotten a pink slip before, but I did retain access to my articles. So I revisited them, which was interesting in and of itself to revisit them, some of them 8-10 years before I began to rework them. They breathed differently, they looked differently, they tasted differently. And so I put them together and put them into a narrative format of a book and sent it around to several publishers, and they said, this is really good, but it doesn't fit our economic model. And I was heartened by Gail reminding me at that point that we went to a conference one time at Lady Lodge, and Madeline Lingle spoke, and she had something like 35 rejections before her first book. I finally found a publisher in Houston who was a perfect fit. She really understood what I was trying to do. She understood me as a writer and me as a faith person. And she helped put the narrative together. So we decided the kind of bottom line is that I really wanted to use the power of stories to paint a collage of healthcare images. So the image we chose is that of stained glass. And that's what the cover is, that's the preface to the book. Talks about stained glass tells a narrative, but each pane in a stained glass window may just be a pane of blue, maybe a pane of red. It doesn't speak to us. It's only when you put the pieces together can you understand what the artist is trying to say. So we chose the three pieces of stained glass for this book. The perspective of the patient, the perspective of the physician or provider, and the perspective of the system itself. So those are the three lenses that we chose to try to express something. And so how the question I began to struggle with is the subtitle of the book is Medicine at the Crossroads, the title. And I bar that, if those of you besides Chuck are into music history, and you know who Robert Johnson was? Great blues guy. Legend is he sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads in the Delta of Mississippi for his great gifts in guitar and music, and lived only a few years after that. But the notion that we're at a crossroads is very important in what I'm trying to say here. Medicine is changing. We've had a 3,000-year-old tradition of medicine being primarily a transactional encounter between two human beings that had a holy edge to it. We've now moved into a corporate, bureaucratic, financial model. And the question I've asked my students to struggle with is, how is it possible to live with the values of the old system while we're transitioning to a new system? And that's the question we're all facing. If any of you are totally happy with your system now, I'd be very surprised. I mean, I've been retired 3 years now. I've been a patient. My wife's been a patient. We've had wonderful health care with great friends and physicians. But the healthcare system's a wreck. I mean, it is a total wreck, I think. And the question is, what can we do to save it besides an economic fix? And one of the things that I hope talks like this do and books like this do, and there's a few of us writing similar veins, I've made contact with a lot of them now, we need to kind of return to a holy covenantal relationship with our patients instead of just a contractual relationship with a provider. William May, a great Christian ethicist from SMU, spoke 20 years ago about healthcare as covenant versus contract. He said contracts are contractual relations between two parties that have fixed, defined boundaries. A covenant has a growing, expansive moral obligation. So when we began to see healthcare as strictly a contract, we're in trouble. And that's part of our problem today. Our contracting can be with our insurance companies, with our government, with our hospitals, with our systems we work for, with our patients. But that misses there's something historically valuable about the way healthcare has been provided for a long, long time. So I want to just review just some brief facts, and I just kind of spent a few time doodling on the board. Anybody know what percentage of our healthcare, what we spend as a nation on healthcare? What percentage?
18%.
18.5%. That may be leveling off, although some predictions are saying it could rise to as high as 20%. Most other westernized first world countries spend about 11 to 12%. So we're spending almost twice as much as any other nation in the world. And I would submit to use economic language that our return on our investment is not. We're getting less bang for the buck. There's a whole lot of reasons for that. We'll articulate hopefully some of those reasons. So our spending is increasing. And I think arguably you could say we have the best healthcare in the world if you're really sick and have good insurance. If you're not one of those two things, you're not only is your access limited or stifled, but your outcomes are arguably not as good. So this is just some historical markers that I wanted you to keep in mind. The blue is the cost of providing health care. The black is the actual reimbursement. You may know what happened in 1965 and what led to that.
Medicare.
Medicare.
So before that point in time, most, you know, look in the 1800s, early part of the 20th century, I found, we have a History of Medicine Museum in Waco. There were bills from doctors in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and $20 to get your gallbladder out, $5 for an office visit. Those days are over, but before that point in time, people could either afford it or they'd trade for it. They'd barter. You know, I'll deliver your baby, bring me a side of beef next time you slaughter your cow. So Medicare happened, and that kind of helped. I mean, doctors fought Medicare. If you look back in the history of the AMA, medical organizations were were really not in favor because guess what word they used?
Socialism.
We can't do this because it's socialism. Well, it turned out to be doctors finally started getting paid for what the work they're doing. And doctors said, well, it's not such a bad deal after all. But costs kept rising. Reimbursement didn't rise as fast, so the gap begins to widen. But in the 90s, costs start going up. And that's a real interesting phenomenon in and of itself. Whole lot of reasons. Research and development. New technology. The dawn of computers in medicine. The merger of hospitals into big systems as opposed to small local community-owned healthcare systems. It's been interesting to note that mergers, which you all in Austin should all know about, there's a big review article in the New York Times a few months ago that reviewed 25 of the last corporate healthcare system mergers. One of the common languages that merger people use in healthcare was, we can hold down costs by merging because we can get better benefits by mass purchasing. 23 of the 25 cost to the consumers went up. They did not live into the promises that justified the merger. So only two of 25 mergers in the last 20 years have really worked as promised. Cost is going up. So computers, salaries, insurance for the provider, all these other things factor in. And the gap widened to the point that in 2010, 25% of Americans had no health care insurance. That was when President Obama was elected. So the problem here is, you know, the cost, whether it's it was escalating, and the ability of the insurance market, the free market, had failed. And one reason is that healthcare is contrary. And in normal supply demand theories, the more you have of something, what should happen?
Prices should go down.
In medicine, the more CT scanners you have, prices go up. And pretty soon, if you have a hammer in your hand, everything starts looking like a nail. So you get more utilization. Some would argue more utilization. So the Affordable Health Care Act, or Obamacare, became a central issue here. Now, what's happened since then? Costs are still going up. Insurance has grown a little bit. We now have about 12 to 14% with no insurance as opposed to 25. But no matter what the market does, they're not going to get rid of this gap. They're not going to get rid of the fact that costs are escalating beyond the ability of the private sector to do it. Even if hypothetically you've got, I mean, insurance works by getting low-risk people in the pool. And I think even if every person in America had access, there's still going to be a differential gap here between the ability of public and private sectors to meet the costs of current health care in America. Your question?
Yes.
Okay.
I wonder about two myths. I call them myths because I don't know if they're really true. What about the aging population? Is that an explanation for the higher growth and the more
doctors?
The disparity continuing to grow? And what about expectations? I have a feeling, based on no research or anything, that our expectations have changed in this country. I lived overseas the last 20 years, and coming back, I feel that there's an increased expectation on what you need, what you deserve. Maybe it's new world.
Great perspectives. It's interesting. Expectations. Let me just kind of give you two answers through this particular analysis. One of the things we've not decided in this country is whether healthcare is a fundamental right of citizenship or whether it's a commodity that can be bought and traded on the open market and should respond like any other commodity, whether it's treasury bills, gold, dollars, stocks, whatever. Thinking of it strictly as an economic problem is the wrong answer. That's where our politicians are stuck. They can't get out of trying to fix this through economic models because they're continuing to think of it as basically a commodity. It's only, and I would say it's not certainly not a right of the Constitution, but the Declaration of Independence would say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We can't pursue the happiness that our lives call us to do as human beings, and justly, I would say, created in the image of God, if we don't view healthcare as a right. Now, people can take exception with that, that's just my personal opinion. Certainly, our expectations are that healthcare can solve all of our problems. And those are delusional expectations. You know, the question becomes, we're spending, again, part of this gap here, you might want to guess what percentage of national federal healthcare spending is spent in the last 30 days of life in terminal illnesses?
Oh, 40%.
25%. One-fourth of all of our dollars in this country is spent in the last 30 days of life in terminal illnesses. Mm-hmm. And I would submit, if we didn't do anything else but change that 25% to 5%, we would have enough to provide health care for everybody in the country. So the question then becomes not how you raise, you know, it's not an argument about raising more money, raising taxes, or spending less. It's about reallocation of the resources we already have.
How do you do that particular situation?
Well, those are good questions. We have to be reasonable and wisdom, and I'll get to this in a little bit, about those kind of decisions. And I think a lot of it is patient education, teaching us all what's real. Just because we have the technology to do something doesn't mean you should do something. Doctors are not very good about making that decision, quite honestly. For one reason, a lot of doctors now, as reimbursements have played such a role, have had to invest in partnerships with technology that raise the cost for everybody. So, I'll give you an example. Here's a trick question. What disease has diagnosis to death coverage in America?
Diabetes?
End-stage
renal.
End-stage renal disease.
Sorry.
Kidney failure.
So
breast cancer, all of that.
Say what that means.
If you're diagnosed with end-stage renal disease, at that point you're eligible for your dialysis or a transplant, and every nickel that is spent, the federal government's going to pay for it.
Right now, that's the case.
Yeah, so breast cancer, heart disease, hypertension, Alzheimer's, no other diagnosis has a diagnosis to death guarantee. And so guess what happens? All those dialysis patients, doctors know that, and order a blood test every time because they get 10 cents on the dollar. So it doesn't make sense. When I heard chairman of the local kidney group, he said, you guys didn't get that in heart disease, we had a better lobbyist than you did.
Oh.
But it raises the ethical question, why do we have one set of standards for one diagnosis and other standards for other diagnoses? So, you know, our expectations, if you're a 90-year-old demented amputee in a nursing home and your kidneys start to fail, your institution has to offer you the possibility of dialysis, or they can be subject to federal penalties. So the question is then, what do we do about that end-of-life expenditures? Well, I think education, pastoral counseling, spiritual counseling has to kind of teach people that we're not immortal. You know, remember, I actually have a quote from Chuck in my book on end-of-life expectations. I'll never forget this. It's from Ash Wednesday, and Chuck goes up and he said, "You all are dying. We're just all dying at a different rate." So realistic end-of-life expectations can help shrink this gap. I think we have to be frank about our discussions. I mean, politically, I hate to go out on a limb here because I know there are always exceptions. The Democratic solution would say that it's a right. The Republican solution would say that it's a commodity. I think it's fundamentally important to look at that through that particular lens, because thinking of it as a commodity means it's a transactional economic model that you can fix by tinkering with the economics of it. Assuming it's a fundamental right of citizenship changes the way we feel about it, nothing else. So, part of the book is I wanted to lay out a vision for healthcare that had, for me, it had a Christian foundation. And I took three classic virtues, and I'd like to walk you through each of these. And this flowed from a series of talks I gave at Belmont University by a mutual friend of Chuck's and I, Todd Lake, asked me to come in and talk about healing from a Christian perspective. That's a whole different book. We can maybe touch on that at the end if you'll want to. But I began to be bothered by the fact that in Waco, we have two faith-based hospitals, a Baptist hospital and a Catholic hospital. They both have very good vision statements. And yet a lot of doctors there who identify themselves as Christian refuse to take call for the indigent or the poor. Well, that's kind of odd. I didn't quite get my head around that. I'll never forget walking down the hall with two family practice residents. I was attending cardiologists with some sick patients. And they had a morning Bible study, and yet they were complaining about taking care of this homeless guy on a ventilator. And I just called him to task. I said, you just got out of a Bible study, and you're complaining about not getting paid for this guy on a ventilator that needs you right now? I said, there's something wrong with this. So the talk I gave at Belmont talked about three things: compassion, wisdom, and justice. Let me talk a little bit about empathy. Empathy, and the reason I'm kind of tuned in on this right now, I got asked to speak at a national conference on empathy and medicine at Mass General in September. Empathy is the ability to feel what the other person's going through in the depth of yourself. Not just to take pity on them, not just to say, oh, that's sad. It calls you to really get your head around the biological issues, the physical issues, the spiritual issues, the wholeness of who that human being is. And that there are ways to develop empathy in medical school curriculum. And that's kind of one of the things I'm working on in retirement now, is how to teach empathy in physicians. But empathy, if it doesn't flow out of yourself, becomes just a form of narcissism. So empathy without action is a problem. Empathy that leads you into a life of compassion, of course, the Latin of this derivative, to suffer with, passion week. It means we walk with Christ on the road to our crucifixion. We die to ourselves. And so compassion is the action you take when you live a life of empathy. That changes everything. That changes. Instead of, you tell your front desk, I'm sorry, I can't take any more Medicare patients, you have to say, okay, how can I accommodate my practice to need to take care of more Medicare patients or more indigent patients? The other thing about this gap, just to remind you, is that we're still up here in this gap. Some states, because they expanded the Medicaid program, we refuse to do that. We've widened that. So a life of compassion, so when you have particularly hospitals, faith-based hospitals like you have here in Austin, you have to look behind the language of the mission statement to see how they're really living a life of Christian compassion. Often there's a kind of cognitive dissonance between mission statements and practice. We see that in church life and corporate life. That's the difference between orthodoxy versus orthopraxis, to use theological language. Orthodoxy is saying the right words. Orthopraxis is doing the right things. What did Jesus have to say about that?
Do the right thing.
Pretty clear. So having a compassion that flows from an empathetic understanding of the nature of the human condition is foundational for any Christian healthcare provider or system. The second thing, though, is wisdom, and that gets back to your question, is how do we use our technology wisely? I have a sentence in here, I don't know what page it's on. But I say we've become impoverished caretakers of the human condition. We're very good at looking at CT scans and reading lab reports, but we don't have the wisdom to know how to really put those reports into the life of the patient. So wisdom, you know, unfortunately, our common notion of wisdom has to do with we get it as we get older. Some do, some of us do, and some don't. Some take longer, and some take shorter. But I've told young 20-year-old pre-med students, unless you can embrace this notion, you're gonna waste too much money on behalf of your patients. When, you know, not everybody that comes in with a headache needs a CT scan. That's a discerning process. It's a wisdom issue. So wisdom is about proper use of the technological gifts we've been given. That's how we reduce that 25% expenditures at the end of life, is using wisdom in our collective consciousness to look at this in a different way. And then finally, any model must embrace justice. The Jewish notion of justice had to do not with everybody being created equal. It means that nobody was denied entrance into God's kingdom. Yes?
The wisdom thing, how much does liability and suing figure into that? Because I think sometimes tests are ordered to protect the doctor in case he misses something.
Yeah, you know, the issue of making medical decisions based on the risk of litigation is a specious argument. First of all, since tort reform in Texas, malpractice suits are very rare. I had, in 41 years of practice, I had one suit and got dismissed. So I just never made that an issue. I just treated people like I thought I'd want to be treated. And if they weren't happy, then come talk to me about it. I think doctors still fall back on that argument, but I don't think that's true. I think there's a complex lot of reasons for that. But part of wisdom and justice, and it means being frank with patients about what's realistic, and then embracing the fact that a lot of people simply are not going to be able to afford what you need to, and you're going to have to figure out a way to make that happen. Now, that's society's problem, not you or me as a patient or as a provider. So I think this next election will be very interesting because we're going to have a big national discussion, and they probably are not going to use this language, but if you look for it in the debates, this will be the language. Is healthcare a right or a commodity? I want to read with you a little bit about my summation, and then I think we can just have some questions and answers. I wrote this, the end of this book is a letter to the next generation. And I really wanted it to be not only for providers, but for patients. So the next group of patients, which is all us, really, and the next group of doctors. This is just kind of my farewell letter, partly to myself. I find myself standing at a crossroads of exhilaration and grief. I've taught my students that doctors are prone to identity confusion. More than in many other professions, we confuse our work with our essence. Does that ring a bell for any over here? Surely I tell them who we are is something fundamentally different than what we do every day. Now yet I realized that being a physician was so deeply rooted in my being, I knew I was heading into deep waters. I was experiencing a form of grief, for I miss medicine every day. 3 years later, I'm sure I still do. I'm losing a part of myself that I know I may never get back. In many ways, it is, as I have written, a form of death. The old self is dying, and I'm not totally sure what kind of self will take its place. We could use that same language for the system. The old system is dying. We're not sure what the new system is going to be. And Chuck would tell you, anybody in any kind of counseling position could tell you, transitions are the hardest. When you're transitioning as a new vision under Chuck's leadership, transition into a new vision with your family, transitioning from work to retirement, transitioning from a healthcare system that's flawed to one that hopefully would be better. Once you come out of the other end of the tunnel, things tend to settle down. People get more content. But the transition years are the hardest. The old self is dying, and I'm not totally sure what kind of self will take its place, which, of course, is the same spiritual paradox we all find ourselves when we live long enough. We must die to ourselves in order to be born again. And for my own personal crossroads, I feel that it is not unlike the crossroads at which our healthcare system now stands. During the incredible span of time that I was in medicine, there was much reason to be exhilarated. I saw the dawn of technology, with patients were afforded procedures and devices that were not in anyone's imagination when I began. I saw the birth of computers and imaging change our fundamental understanding of disease and how we diagnose and treat the neediest of patients. I saw electronic medical records supplant simple listening and presence and touch. I saw the infancy of gene manipulation and its endless possibilities for our common good. And yet, there has also been much to grieve about healthcare. As the science and technology have exploded, there has been an inverse curve in our understanding of the nature of the human condition. That's my favorite sentence in the whole book. Students and residents have become extremely good at ordering tests and prescribing new medications, but do not yet have the gift of wisdom to know when to use them. We've been generating sterile and meaningless reports in order to code at higher reimbursement levels, and over time, we have become impoverished caretakers of the human soul and spirit, confusing good science with mature reasoning and compassion. Our healthcare system has failed on so many levels. And so we find ourselves fragmented, lost, wandering in the desert of our moral and spiritual landscape. We are thirsty, and the streams from which we are drinking are not sustaining us. If we don't find our way back home, we'll certainly lose the precious gifts we were bequeathed by those that have gone before. So, I'm afraid that this book probably has raised a lot more questions than it's provided answers. But I think as you listen to the national dialogue in the next few years, kind of keep these virtues in the back of your mind and keep the fundamental issue price versus commodity, because that'll give you, that should become your North Star, your Lone Star, how you deal with these. Yes, sir?
Take the rights versus commodities to some reasonable end. If we stay with rights, do we narrow that gap?
Yeah.
If we stay with commodity, do we narrow the gap?
There's always a trade-off, correct? I mean, if we say it's strictly a commodity, imagine treating healthcare as a strictly as a commodity. That takes us back to 2010. That's why Obama, for all the flaws in the Affordable Health Care Act, it was an attempt to treat it as a right, to bring more people into it. I think those are still, there's always a trade-off. Somebody asked me what would be the ideal health care system, and I think I've talked to a lot of doctors on both sides of the political aisle. We all, you know, without using the word socialism, a lot of us think a two-tier system is inevitable. That we have a standard, basic healthcare national system without taking over practices and hospitals that provides a fundamental safety net of healthcare for everybody. That's the Chevrolet. You want to drive a Mercedes? You can buy it on the open market. You want dialysis when you're 90? You go pay for it yourself. You want a valve replacement when you're 92 or defibrillator when you're 95? You know, we have to draw some boundaries about what society can do. So a two-tier system seems to be the way we're headed. Ooh, it's going to back first and work way forward.
I'm kind of shifting to personal care, personal interaction with your physician, but there's a lot of emphasis on the patient's responsibility and holding the physician accountable. Mm-hmm. But it's really difficult to know how to ask the right question. I mean, what would you recommend in terms of asking the right questions, dealing with your
it's
doctor?
It's the patient's job to ask the questions and the doctor's job to listen and answer. Now, The problem is that the doctor's behind a computer and looking at his clock and trying to pick the right boxes so he can code at the right level. He's not going to listen to you. He or she is not going to listen to you.
So what do you do?
I'm kind of old school. I refuse to bring laptops into the room when I saw patients.
But the patient has a responsibility to ask the question. You can't be just dumb-sitting.
Exactly. You can't be a passive and then complain that, well, I didn't get what I wanted.
My question that I've been trying to think out here is, without my paid-for insurance, how am I going to determine what my right to medical care is? I mean, we've already discussed that there's a period of time when you should give it up, but what should I demand as my right? How much medical care do I have a right to when I'm not paying for it? Except for taxes.
Taxes and kidney failure. You have a right to those two things.
Where'd you say taxes and what?
Kidney failure.
You can choose kidney.
Yeah. The Medicare for All sounds, that's a slogan. And with all due respect to Sanders and Warren, it's not, Medicare itself is fine. There's an unequal distribution of the way services are reimbursed. Some services are reimbursed enough that doctors actually make a little bit of money on them. Many doctors that have a big Medicare population lose money. You can't make a living on seeing an office patient for 30 minutes and getting $56 for an office visit. So a lot of problems in Medicare that have to be addressed before you start applying, saying Medicare for All.
Yes. So my wife was in the hospital last year for about 6 weeks, and there was something new that I think was a deterioration of compassion, and that was the hospitalist.
Mm-hmm.
And her doctor that she's seen for 25 years and knows and trusts very much
doesn't come
to the hospital. Yeah. That was a real failing, I thought.
I tell you when that started. I mean, this whole thing between 1990 and 2010, this emergence of hospitalist doctors being practices being acquired by big systems. The system said, oh, I'll pay you a guaranteed salary. You get to be home at 4:30 every day. We'll hire a hospitalist to provide coverage for you. I saw the disaster. That's a train wreck in progress. I warned people about that 30 years ago. I was sick in the hospital myself in November. I got splenic septic shock after some surgery. And it was pretty scary. But I will say this, my hospitalist probably knew I had kind of up my hiney about that. He didn't bring his computer into the room.
Yeah.
He did his computer work outside the room, sat in and examined me and listened to me for 30 minutes, and went about out to do his data entry.
And you're also at the mercy of the hospitalist who doesn't even know you.
I mean,
now you can go home and not go.
You know, this whole thing, I mean, it's easy to point. They say in medicine, the retrospectoscope is it's easy to see in hindsight, you know, where we went wrong. But when electronic medical records or electronic health records were mandated under President Bush, and Mike Leavitt was the Secretary of Health and Human Services, that sounded like a noble venture. Well, they didn't standardize the data, the way all these things were stored. So your doctors records can't talk to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Even two branches of the hospital may choose different versions of Epic, which is one of the big systems. So you get all these, they should have standardized the way it's all coded and written so that all the systems can access each other. They're so concerned about patient privacy and HIPAA issues that it's just a fragmented mess right now. You know, even if the doctor's practice is owned by the hospital, doctor's office may use a version that can't talk to the hospital. So the hospitalist at 2 in the morning can't access the doctor's office records and say, what's going on? That makes no sense. Yes?
I just wanted to comment on a couple of things.
Which
is that, we don't have to figure this out all on our own. European nations that have longer life expectancies and similar population and health problems as the United States have already done a lot of this work. So figuring out what should be in a baseline program, what should be in private insurance, has already been figured out because the system is already in place in Germany. And as a population health person, I'm actually chair in the United States Section of Population Health, I can tell you, we already know the things that are going to maximize population health, how expensive they are, and whether or not they're a good investment. That's what a lot of really smart people at Harvard and Stanford and Duke and all those other places are figuring out. The problem is actually getting our politicians to listen to those people who know and understand what's going on in the healthcare system, and to get them to stop listening to lobbyists and start doing what's in the public interest.
Well, that's excellent. Population health is a phrase that's kind of emerged from the public health sector about how disease impacts large groups of people and what how the finances of it, the transactional part of it take place. It's going to be a huge contribution, but it's not easy for politicians to get their head around. But it's too easy to talk about any big government is evil and socialist. Anything that has market overturns is capitalistic and greedy. We kind of have to get away from that binary thinking about this.
I'd also say that we have a huge evidence base about what things should be done in different agents for different diagnoses as well. So there's a big understanding of why don't do dialysis on someone who's 95 years old or whatever else. So I think it's really incumbent on us to stop saying what should we do and start looking around at the other countries that are so similar to the United States that have already been
discussed. She's alluding to the fact that I kind of tiptoed around it, but our public health outcomes, we're spending all this 19% of our GDP, whether it's maternal mortality rates, childhood death rates, all these major diseases, we're not anywhere in the top 20.
And we're going down. Yeah. Not up.
Yes.
You alluded to the fact that 25% of our health care budget goes in the last,
30 days.
30 days. It seems like that's the low-hanging fruit that would be the easiest to get to.
Yeah, that's when patients are the most vulnerable. And I mean, I can, I'll tell you just another observation. I don't have the data to back it up, but I can tell you, I'm pretty sure it's true because I've talked to you about that. The more marginalized a person or family is in life, the more they want out of end of life care and death. An affluent, educated population, it's very easy to talk to them about. When Chuck's father died, we sat around, Chuck and I, his mom lives there, and sat around with Chuck and his two daughters about disconnecting his father from the respirator. You can't have that population with a minority because it's or somebody who's been pushed to the margins already. I want everything done for Uncle Johnny. So those are some of the cultural parameters that we have to be respectful that not everybody shares the same expectations about end of life as we do. Yes, sir.
My question is, I had heard a story and a doctor was saying basically that he was tired of seeing his patients, his indigent patients, not get the care that he felt like his more affluent and better insured patients were getting. So I guess my question is whether that juncture, because of, you know, there's kind of a wisdom judgment thing here, that whether that juncture doesn't happen at an earlier point for someone who doesn't have access to the same insurance that you or I might, because they're not going to be offered all of the same interventions that you or I might.
I think it depends a lot on who the provider works for. If he works, I mean, we're lucky in Waco. I'll tell you a quick story that tiptoes around this a little bit. I was on call one weekend when Bush 43 was president. One of his cabinet members that had a cabinet meeting at the ranch went into atrial fibrillation, had some big complications. Got admitted, super nice guy. The bed next to him, homeless guy under the bridge, found unconscious, also an atrial fibrillation. Same diagnosis, same doctor, same nursing staff, same technology, same medication, same outcome. They both were discharged 3 days later. They got the same standard of care with both. And I was proud of Waco for doing that. But in some places, they would not have given the patient B much access to technology. You don't like the term we say, it's not very nice, but
it is a wallet biopsy. I don't think we should be doing wallet biopsies on our patients. My job to go in and work and save lives.
Wallet biopsy.
I have a question about medical education. My college roommate, one of my closest friends, is on the medical school faculty at UT Southwestern, and I sort of have the sense that that curriculums that are not super hard science, at least in some schools, sort of considered love or and I just wonder how you deal with that or like this.
So this is interesting because at Baylor, when I approached Baylor in 1998 with the possibility of a medical humanities degree, that was the pushback from the science was just going to be too tough. And so the pre-med curriculum is pretty codified. You have to take so many hours of biology, chemistry, etc. But given that, we felt my formation, the word we would use in crystal chart, formation can change people, can change their expectations. It's to change the way they practice medicine. We started doing this 20-something years ago now, and I get emails from patients in the early classes that are now in practice that say, your classes, they really helped. They helped me do a better job of what I think I was missing in medical school. Traditional medical school is survival. You're like a cat hanging on the trapeze. I think these virtues can be taught. I think they can be modeled. I think the earlier we capture the students, the better. By the time you're 45, discussed with your practice and the contract they've signed, it's too late then. So we can start early as a culture. We can build these values into. One thing Dell is doing, I don't remember his name now, one of the associate deans at the new medical school here gave a talk at our medical staff Christmas party, and there are kind of three standard tracks in medical school education, science, I forgot what the other two are. Dell has a fourth track called joy. I think that's great. The practice of medicine, I mean, there was not a day that I didn't think this is the coolest thing I could have. There were days I was broken and grieving and pissed off and hurt, but that's what we're human, it happens. But if you don't find that fundamental joy deep down, you kind of, I think you're in the wrong field. And that can be taught. I believe it can be taught. Yes, sir.
Can we get you back about once a month between now and the election so we can kind of update what we're seeing and hearing?
Talk to Chuck. I think it's important, and I'm not trying to tell you who to vote for, but don't believe either politician that says this is a simplistic. We've got the answers.
They don't have the answers.
No. I think they're out there.
Well, if we could just get them to talk to each other, it's going to help.
Yes, sir. I just had a comment and a question for you. I appreciate you talking about end of life. I see people all the time. Most people I talk to want to die at home, but then they end up dying in the hospital. So I think that's an important thing to bring up, and I appreciate that.
I think the palliative care movement as opposed to the hospice movement is woken up to the fact that most people don't want these excessive technologies at the end of life. Mm-hmm. But a lot of patients still have those expectations. So that's where we set ourselves up for criticism, is when we don't honor the patient's expectations, but we can listen and give them some feedback. So have you thought about this? When Lou's husband passed away, we had to make a very hard decision whether to take him off the respirator, knowing that if he didn't breathe on his own, that was it. We prayed together about it, and we made a decision to do it. Those kind of conversations take time. Time is the one commodity that we never feel like we have enough of, whether it's a patient or a provider. Yeah.
So has hospice care helped?
Helped my mother here in Austin when she passed away a few years ago. They were wonderful with her. Wonderful, and I could not have asked for a better hospice team.
I think that having worked hospice, I think a lot of early education from the very beginning that the patient, yes, the patient has rights, the patient needs to ask the questions. They need to look and be aware and be willing to interrupt the doctor who's on the computer and say, look, I'm concerned about this or that. And maybe put your hand over on the screen and say, look at me, listen to me. And maybe that's how we as patients can push them to the point where we need their, them to take care of us.
I don't want to, how much more time do we have?
Got
2 minutes. Another talk I've given on the nature of the healthcare provider. If you think back to the early shamanistic days, early healers, before written history, what did the shaman do? He was the local botanist, he was the local surgeon, he was the local spiritual person to accompany the people to the underworld. He was a community sociologist. So he's all these different things, all these different roles in one entity. So what happened in the 18th century with the scientific revolution and the dawn of new theology? All those roles get triaged. So now, you know, the doctor is just supposed to deal with biology. You got the pastoral person, the social worker, the nurse, the, you know, therapeutic model. So all these things got bifurcated, trifurcated, triaged out. And so you don't, the patient's kind of lost right now. They don't know who to turn to. And that's not to say we need to go back to the doctor being the all-powerful world, you know, shaman, but we have to understand that the patient's real needs requires at least those different entities to be able to talk to each other.
Exactly. It doesn't happen.
They don't know.
Excuse me for interrupting, but the computer, as great as it is, and technology as great as it is, they don't, it doesn't.
It's sterilizing.
It really does. It doesn't allow these various entities to talk together. It takes more time to do the stuff on the computer than you have to talk with the patient.
Yes.
Do you think that medicine still attracts the same type of person that?
You know, I get around to that a little bit in one of the early chapters of the book. One of my favorite, you know, when I was teaching, why do you want to do this? Because it's going to be hard. You hear all kinds of answers. Some I like problems. I want to go do mission work, or I want to do research. And, you know, one student said, I want to make a lot of money. I said, transfer over to the school of business. You need to get a degree in entrepreneurship. So I think we have to recognize that people go into medicine for a lot of different reasons. A lot of them are beautiful and inspiring, and others are callous. I think the big thing I would say young people do differently that I've tried to counter in my classes is trust the process enough to allow yourself to be wounded. Henry Nouwen wrote a book called The Wounded Healer. My generation is taught, don't go into the personal life of the patient. Don't go down that road. Well, I just never worked for me. So I went to their funerals, their weddings, their bar mitzvahs, and, you know, their life events. And, you know, I was not a small town country family doctor. It was a, fairly sophisticated cardiology practice. But that level of horizontal relationships carried me through the dark night. And I think that's one of the reasons that the burnout rate is so high. Doctors are, somebody earlier asked the question about aging population. There's several curves that are not working in our favor. Aging population, more doctors retiring in their 50s, more women doctors, which we need more of. They're going half time. How do we recruit them with that? Yeah. So all of these curves are going in the wrong direction. We can't double the size of medical school quickly. We can't train enough physicians, so we're going to have to use more physician extenders, more PAs, nurse practitioners. But I think if you look at satisfaction scores in young physicians, we're seeing higher suicide rates, higher admissions for depression, higher consults for mental illness. Young doctors, and I say young between 30 and 55, dropping out. And I think because they didn't buy into the model that it's okay to tell your patients.
body practice. It's not going to be perfect. Nothing in life is perfect. It's only about allowing yourself to be hurt.
I'm not a physician, but I'm a retired RN, and part of the burnout, and for me anyway, and the sadness is there is the access to care. I know it's out there. I know what I work with pediatrics with kids, and they just can't sometimes get the care that they need, and that's very depressing.
Guys, there's no justification.
And if their parents are ill and can't get the care their parents need, it's a tremendous impact on family.
You know, the other thing to keep in mind though is language, that adequate insurance doesn't necessarily convert to accessibility.
Yeah.
Accessibility is a whole complex issue that has to do with transportation.
Oh, we have just had 15, 20 hospitals in West Texas that are closed.
Yeah. How many miles of the car for it to go?
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.